May 9th, 2019, and I'm here talking to Don Ferrari. I'm Keith Sweet from the Amador County Historical Society, and we're taping this interview in Don's residence in Jackson. Thank you for participating in this Amador County American Living History Project. We appreciate your willingness to preserve our county's history by sharing your memories. This conversation is being tape recorded. Tapes will be made available to the public without charge. If you share something during the next hour you regret saying on tape, we'll make every effort to remove it.
Understand.
So, thank you for sitting down and talking to me this morning, Don. Why don't we just start with maybe your family history back? Who's the first person that came in your relation that came to Amador County?
That would be Domenico Fuguria. Domenico Fuguria was from Liguria, near Genoa, in Italy. And he came to, first to New York in about 1845-46, and spent 3 or 4 years up and down the east coast of the United States. But following what the news and all about the gold rush in California, he and several other people that came from the same area of northern Italy decided they wanted to come west and find out what was happening. So along about 1850, after making one trip back to Italy, Domenico Fuguria came to Amador County, along with two other gentlemen. They had all been officers in the Austrian army prior to that and had retired from the Austrian army. All of northern Italy at that time, thanks to Napoleon, was eventually part of Austria, and he retired as an officer. Domenico had never been married, had no other children, of course, and one of his traveling partners had his 15-year-old daughter. And at the ripe old age of 51, Domenico married a 15-year-old girl, Caterina, and they proceeded to have 8 children, all in Amador County. And that's the Fuguria side, or the name Fuguria. My grandmother was the third or fourth child born, and her name was Clara Fuguria. And she married my grandfather, who was Angelo Ferrari, also from Genoa, Italy, or nearby, small village out just outside of Genoa. I've been fortunate enough to visit many different times, actually.
When did your grandfather come here?
Came here, approximate date would be approximately 1875 to 1880 to Amador County. He was born under the following circumstances. His father owned a ship, and his business was trading goods from Italy and France to South America and eventually to San Francisco. And on a trip to South America, going around the Horn, eventually to San Francisco, my great-grandmother was pregnant, and my great-grandfather decided it was too arduous a trip to take a pregnant woman around the Cape of Good Hope. And so he left her in Montevideo, Uruguay, and completed the trip to San Francisco and picked her up on his return. But he picked up his wife and his new son, which was my grandfather. And they went back to Italy. And so once he got back to Italy, my grandfather stayed there until he was 18, in a large family. And it was sort of designed that he was to become the priest in the family. And they wanted him to go into a seminary to study. And he had other ideas. He went back to Uruguay, and within weeks went to Buenos Aires and became an Argentine citizen. He then, 3 years later, left, for whatever reason, came to San Francisco and then came to Amador County. One of the two partners that my great-grandfather, Fugulia, brought with him, or they came as a group, three, from Northern Italy, was a man named Peter Ferrari. But he spelled it F-E-R-A-R-I. However, everybody else put the two R's in, F-E-R-R-A-R-I. We have assumed that he came because he was related somehow to Peter Ferrari. How would he end up in a small town like Jackson from Buenos Aires when there was only one other person named Ferrari? So that's the geology of all this. So,
right.
It was a long trip.
I mean, so many things are running through my mind just in listening to what you've said so far. I mean, can you imagine taking your wife, a pregnant wife, to New York and then having to leave and just drop her off there and then come back and say, I'll pick you up on my way back?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a...
I understand.
I mean, I understand why they did it in terms of the difficulty in traveling, but, I mean, how much emotion had to be tied up in having done that?
Well, many left their wives in Italy, as did many of the other people, came to New York first. Now, right. In some of the log books and other family documents I have, they talk about Domenico, who was born in 1801, talks about in New York City, when he arrived, that he had $2, and that a lovely lady he met on board the ship loaned him $3. And with $5, she bought an organ grinder and a monkey and proceeded for the next 4 years to go up and down the streets of New York, but then traveled to Atlanta, Georgia, and all these other places and commented about how kind the black people in Atlanta were, that they made silk clothes for his monkey and all these things, and how he made enough money from his organ grinder to go back to Italy and bring other relatives back with him to come back. So I don't know all of the minutia
right.
of that, but that's what it was.
So you've obviously done some research on your family. Did have a lot of some of these stories just been passed down over time, and have you? How'd you dig out a lot of this stuff?
Well. My aunts were all very proud of the family history and stayed in contact with people still surviving or living. I think by this time all the ones that we had any contact with are gone because my, but they would tell me these stories. And we had my great grandmother's brother became a very highly decorated individual in the state of California. His name was Angelo Noce, N-O-C-E. Angelo Noce was the first official translator for the state of California for Italian and English. He graduated from St. Mary's College when it was still in San Francisco. One of the people he worked with, his first job was working for the San Francisco Chronicle, was Samuel Clemens. So he had that. He also attended classes at Santa Clara. He then moved to Nevada when the silver strike came and started his own newspaper there. And when that silver mine worn out, he went to Colorado and he started a newspaper there called La Stella, which was, whatever it means, the largest Italian newspaper in the state of Colorado. He was a born politician. He convinced Jesse McDonald, the governor of Colorado, to be the first state to make Columbus Day an official state holiday. He then, after this, traveled largely by horseback and railroad to 32 other states and got 32 other governors to finally sign in. And Angelo Noce was the first Grand Marshal of the Columbus Day Parade in San Francisco. And that was about 1877 to 1878. So I have some pictures of him, and you know, so on his horseback and on the first Columbus Day parade. He was very, he loved the idea of Columbus. Of course, Columbus came from, supposedly from Genoa, part of Liguria.
Right.
When I was traveling there about, 15 or 20 years ago, I went to the town where he was born, Chicagna, which is 30 miles from Genoa, maybe 20 miles from Genoa. About the size of Jackson, maybe a little bit bigger. Very attractive town, built in a pretty part of the mountains with a stream running through, and you could see trout swimming up from the bridge. And my wife and my sister and my mother arrived about 1 p.m, and most people were taking their siesta for the day. The shops had already closed. And as they went one way, I went the other, and I came around a bend in this little town, and here was a massive white marble statue, larger than life size, maybe almost twice life size, of Christopher Columbus, standing there, and beneath was a large plaque, in English as well as Italian, to his beloved friends and relatives in Chicagna. This is your noble son, Angelo Nucci. I've commissioned this statue of our wonderful Christopher Columbus, and I want everyone, you know, I want the world to know that it was your son, Angelo, who made it a holiday it became finally a national holiday in California. In the United States. And I know that he died in, Angelo Nucci died, I think, about 1922, 23. And my father always commented that Sunday dinners in Jackson quite often, well, he said almost every Sunday Angelo Nucci was there because he's buried here in the cemetery. But that it would be the local priest, usually, or one of the people from the church. And the Angelo Nucci would always give a speech, and all the children had to stay at the table until he finished. And he said they dreaded it because the speech was always at least a half an hour or more about all the wonders of Italy and all the other things. But he was widely traveled. He wrote several books. He wrote a book called Fu Giacomo. It's half in English and half in Italian. But it was written about his father and what a wonderful man his father was. And I have loaned that to other family members, and I've not gotten a return, and I'm pretty upset about it. I'm still trying to get back. I had two copies that were all signed. So that was part of the history of that. But Angelo Nucci was pretty well known because of his travels. There is a little bit of scandal there too, because I was contacted by the Catholic Church here in town that asked me if I would remove the plaque that was embedded in the cement sidewalk in front of the church about Angelo Nucci, the son of Christopher Columbus. They said that some research found that yes, he wasn't very much involved in having Angelo Nucci acknowledged that Christopher Columbus and all the wonderful things he'd done. However, Angelo Nucci's name should not be on church steps because he maintained a separate family in Denver and had children in Denver, as well as a family in Jackson with children in Jackson. And the church didn't think they should have the plaque on the footsteps. It's still around here somewhere in Jackson, where it is at the moment. But
I'll have to look that up. I don't know that I've ever seen it, but
they moved it over right there where the garage was off of. When you come out of the high school and you come down, there was a pillar, and they were going to put it on that. And I haven't noticed when I went by. It's here somewhere. It may be in a church. They may have put it in storage too. But there was another plaque over there acknowledging Angelo Nucci. There's a lot of family things like that around. I was in Denver in business, and I went to the Italian section of Denver, which all cities have their Chinese and Italian and whatever. And I was in like, was a popular bar there. And I was telling a business partner about Angelo Noce, and he called the bartender over and said, "This man's today is Angelo Noce." "Oh, yes. He lived just 2 blocks down the street." And he said, "I'm going to call the priest and have him come over." So he went to call the priest, and the priest came over and he said, "Well, I wasn't here, but I knew the priest who was here when Angelo Noce was here." He said, "The only thing I can tell you is when he passed on," he said he didn't move back to California, "but when he passed on, there were a lot of people that sighed a sigh of relief to see him go back to California." He said he had a family here and he had a family in California.
So it's pretty common knowledge, apparently.
Common knowledge. My aunts never discussed that. I'm sure they might have been aware.
Your great grandfather, I think it was, that was the first one that came to Amador?
Yes.
You know, have you found out why? I mean, was he a miner or get into the mining?
He came here. He and his two partners, I believe they homesteaded, or at least filed gold claims on the Fuguri Ranch, which is here up off of Clinton Road.
Right.
And they actually worked the soil for gold, and it was gold that they actually extracted that paid the tuition for Angelo Noce's schooling at St. Mary's College. They always acknowledge about it. I mean, I've heard that from all my aunts and everything, so that would have been my great-grandmother's brother. And they took gold from there, but what they liked is they had, as the gold dwindled, which it did, they had very little, they had about, out of 160 acres, it was with the initial, they had about 20 or 30 very cool, good acres for growing vegetables and fruit. And they had a small vineyard, and they made wine, and they had cattle, they had cows. They were totally, they were substantial in a living unit taking care of that. There were various partners that came and went at certain times and bought in. At one point in time, the total property was over 600 acres. Today, it's about 300 acres.
Now, today, you're talking about the Fuguri Ranch?
Yeah.
Now, I seem to read sometime in the past about a Ferrari ranch out by the Butte store on Highway 49.
Yeah, that's a relative.
That's a relative.
Yes. Another relative I had was John Kirkpatrick's mother. She was a Ferrari. And Earl Ferrari was another, like, first cousin. I had several uncles here. I had Ernest Ferrari. Angelo, which was the one that was born after his father passed away. And my father's name was Dominic, but everybody was assigned different names, and his nickname was Minnie, M-I-N-N-I-E. Once, when their parents passed away and the family was still very young, they all changed their names, their first names, which they spoke with each other. They never legally changed their names, but like my Angelo, he liked to swim, so his nickname was Ducky, D-U-C-K-Y. My Aunt Bertha Garbarini, they called her Birdie. There was Ducky and Birdie. And for whatever reason, my father's name became Bob, and Ernie became Tom. And so all the children had different names, but only what they used when they spoke with each other. And it used to drive my friends, and even when I got married, my wife, she said, "I can't be, who the hell are these people? I know your father's name is Dominic, but nobody ever calls him, he doesn't like Dominic." She said, "Yeah, but they call him Minnie." I said, "Yeah, that's his nickname." She said, "But no, your Uncle Ernie, who's Tom calls him Bob. Why did they do that? But they all grew up that way.
Right.
With the older sister at Iron Hand making them do all the chores, doing everything. And that was the Ferrari Ranch, which was not the Ferrari Ranch. They came down. We had another 320 acres, which was the Ferrari Ranch, which is 3 miles up Clinton Road. It's people there have now been there for a long time. I can't think of the name right now. That's why I'm glad we're talking. My memory's turning into crap. But, we sold the ranch. My father bought his sisters out and ran the ranch, and he sold it in about 1952 or 53.
You know, you've had Fregulia and Kirkpatrick and Garbarini and Ferrari, Cuneo. You've mentioned all those names as part of your relation.
Garaventa, Argico, Garibaldi, all pretty close to him, like first cousins and that sort of thing.
Years ago, did all those families ever get together for some kind of event or family reunion, or did each one of them have their own? Or
sort of each one of them had their own. I mean, there was always a big function up at the old Milligan School where my grandmother graduated from school there. My grandmother went to school at Milligan School. My father and all the children graduated from the 8th grade at Milligan School. The high school was being built then, but they couldn't think about going to high school. I know my dad always talked about working at the livery stable, which was right next to the National Hotel downtown. And his job was to be there at midnight and work until 8 in the morning and sleep up in the straw up in there where they kept it for the horses. In case somebody came in late, he was there. He'd open the gate and let them in and do that. And so his job, you know, he said most nights he could sleep all night. But he said then there were those nights on the weekends where you couldn't think about sleeping. People were coming and going, or rainstorms. But he worked the full 8 hours, paid practically nothing, I have no idea, but it wasn't much money, I'm sure. But any money was important to a family like that.
Your home here, this property, has this been in the Ferrari family for a long time, or is this just a home you bought at some point in time?
It was built by my uncle. He built it in 1917. His name was Steve Bignotti. He and Teresa, which was a Teresa Figuria, started the Royal Inn down here, the restaurant. And they owned this whole area here, town, this side of the street. They owned the land where the motel is, but they didn't build the motel. The motel was built after they sold it. But the world heavyweight champion fighter, Primo Carnera, loved San Francisco. And I don't know how much you might know about boxing, but Primo Carnera was a giant. He was 6'9". He was just a giant. Very good looking man, and he was world heavyweight champion from Milan, Italy. And he came to San Francisco, and you know, he traveled because everybody wanted to see this giant. And he brought his parents. They did not speak a word of English. I know that his father didn't write because I have a copy of a will or of a real estate purchase. He signed his name with an X, and it was witnessed that he signed with an X. They came here because his parents had relatives working in the mine, and they fell in love with it. They thought Jackson reminded them of Italy, so they wanted to live here. So Primo Carnera went to my uncle and said, I'd like to buy some land. And he said, well, you know, whatever. And he said, I want a house for my parents. Well, my uncle was a very good carpenter. And he said, I'll build it for you. And he said, fine. So Steve Bignotti built this house. And Primo Carnera's mother and father moved in here and stayed here 1 year. And as I understand, his mother cried every day and wanted to go back to Italy. And so he bought the house back from him and then went back to Italy. And it's never left the family since. It was rented, but it was almost always rented to family members or somebody for a period of time. And I inherited it in the late 80s, 1988 or something, and it was in terrible, terrible repair. It had been abused. Most of the older people, my aunt that had owned it directly, was living in Stockton and not taking care of it. The local police chief called me and said, it's become a crack house. People are going in. I came over here and had it all cleaned out. And then I proceeded to... I was going to just use it as a weekend place to get away. But as I got older and my wife got older, I started adding on. Originally it was 1,100 square feet. Now it's about almost 3,000 square feet. I've got a very nice tree house out in back, all made out of Brazilian rosewood. And I've got two-car garage and a large master suite and a beautiful yard and everything. And now this is where I live. This is my residence.
Yeah, for those of you who are listening, we're sitting in Don's kitchen, which is tricked out to be a chef's delight. if you love to cook, you'd love to be in this kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sitting at a table for 12 here in the kitchen, and it's a great talking to you. And it's a lot of glass, sun's shining. I'm sure you spend a lot of time here.
Before we leave, I'm going to show you the backyard. Yes.
So, we're talking about your family's history, but how about a little of your own history?
I went to Milligan School.
Now, which school?
It's a public school. It was. It goes back to 1850s. And you go up Clinton Road, about 4.5 miles. And on the left-hand side, there's a red schoolhouse. And it's got Milligan School. But the district sold it, and some individuals bought it, and they changed it into a home. So,
how do you spell that?
M-I-L-L-I-G-A-N, Milligan.
Okay.
Milligan School. I mean, people around here all know that Cuno's live just up the road from it, and that's where my sister and I went to the first through the sixth grade. The seventh and eighth grade, I was in Colorado. My mother's relatives lived in Colorado, and we raised lots of fruit trees on a ranch here and walnut trees, and I had a terrible allergy to the pollen on the walnut trees and stuff. And when I was in Colorado, I felt great, so for my last 2 years, seventh and eighth grade, I went to Colorado and finished the eighth grade in Colorado and then came back to California, and we moved to Stockton then for a while. I went to Stockton High School. I graduated from there and went to UC Berkeley. And I was at UC Berkeley for 5 years. I started as a pre-med major and spent 3 years as a pre-med major. And then finally realized I had 7 more years at minimum to go. And I finally switched over to organic chemistry. And I was given professional status by a Stauffer Chemical Company because they wanted me to go to Italy and work on a project which was a joint venture with Monte Cassini. And I was thrilled. I went to Italy for 6 months, and we worked on a pre-emergence herbicide for different types of agricultural products. And that triggered my looking at other things as well. Again, it came back to a health problem. In a laboratory, there's all kinds of vapors that are very tough on your lungs. And I was getting pneumonia every year. And I had developed a bronchiectasis, and my doctor said, you can't be around these toxic things. So I went to work at Dean Whittling Company as a stockbroker in San Francisco. And I was there for 11 years. and then started my own company. I moved to Los Angeles. I was in the mutual fund business, and then moved to New York and merged the company I had with another mutual fund management company, Arnold Bernhard, Valley Line Securities in New York. And the rest of my professional life, I was involved in financing specialty type real estate, but particularly medical office properties. A lot of hospitals in the 70s and 80s, even earlier, to attract doctors, built medical facilities very near the hospital, right on the hospital property if they could, or within a block or two to bring the doctors in. But many of these hospitals realized they didn't know much about managing real estate. Doctors are not the easiest tenants either. And so a lot of them were happy to sell. And my company and I formed a real estate trust, and we raised a couple of $1 billion, and at one point in time we owned 177 medical office properties.
Wow.
Some as small as a kidney dialysis that would be maybe 15 or 20,000 square feet, and some as large as 200,000, 300,000 square feet, a regular complete medical facility. So it's treated me well. It was a
that word started with a B, not an M, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's total purchase price. I mean, we raised about $500 million and bought about $2 billion worth of property.
So, and part of your job then was traveling around and managing those or checking up on them. That's what was
involved. Yeah, it was a combination. I was president of the company most of the time. And most of our investors were institutions, were endowment funds, insurance companies, universities, retirement programs. So I'd always go around. It was a big smile and tell them how great your investment was doing. But in fact, it did do well. I mean, we had an average annual return of a little over 10%, somewhere between 11 and 12%. That was appreciation plus cash. But we had cash return usually in the 5 or 6% range. And we had an appreciation factor over a protracted period. Any 1 year might not be so much, but we usually average at least a 7 or 8% appreciation plus a 4, 5, 6% cash flow. Good. That satisfied these people managing their money.
Well, you did well with your Dean Witter experience.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe it's the history of my family being able to just pick up and leave Italy and get on a boat, not sure what they're going to do or what they're going to do. I love to travel. I love to go. I'll be 82 in a couple of weeks. I'm 81, I'll be 82 June 1st. I just love to travel. I have traveled a lot. And I just came back from 2.5 months in Italy. I made 2 trips over there. I went over for 2 months and came back and decided a bunch of stuff I wanted to do. So a week later, I climbed back on the plane. I went back again for 2.5 more weeks. I've had some medical things that slowed me down a bit, but anyway, yes.
Yeah, for those of you who are listening, I've been trying to get this interview with Don for the last 4 years now.
Yeah.
Back to your family settling here. So your great-great-grandfather came over, I think
right.
That's still right, and settled here. And then did he bring others over? Was there a Ferrari clan then, kind of?
No, just one of the two retiring Austrian army. They were all in the Alpine Corps. They called them the Alpine. They wore those Robin Hood hats with feathers in them. And it used to be you had to be 6 feet tall. And there were not many people that were 6 feet tall, but Domenico was 6 feet tall.
Very unusual.
Yeah. I think they relaxed that eventually, but they weren't the big, tall guys. Anyway, one of the two was Peter, and it was Peter Ferrari, but in some of the documents you just spell it F-E-R-A-R-I. And I questioned the Fuguria family about this. And they said, oh yeah, it probably was F-E-R-R-A-R-I, but you know, it was easier just for F-E-R-A-R-I. And maybe when he became naturalized citizen here, they might have misspelled it wrong too. I don't know. But it was the only one with a name anyway, near Ferrari at that time. So, and why did my grandfather come here from Buenos Aires to here? And there's only one of the four. They had to be related.
Sure.
Yeah. I went back to the town where he was born with a letter, and it was a letter dated like 1958 in Italian. And I pulled it into a small place. I mean, it's small. The church, it was just a church, and down the front was those who died in the war, World War One, E Morte, you know, World War One. And you think it was Jack and me, Cuno, Garibaldi, all the names, Italian names you see here, every one of them. And I gave the slayer, you know, people circled around me, and I gave them the slayer, and oh yes. And then all of a sudden they all left. I'm standing there with my wife, and we're in this town square, and there's nobody. Some little kids playing off on one side, that's it. Everybody left. What's up? Well, maybe they didn't, I don't know, maybe they didn't like what's going on. So we got back in the car, and just when we got in the car, they all came back out. And they came over and they handed a letter back to me. Emorte, Emorte. Whoever the letter was that died, they didn't want to tell me they died. I said, hey, que sera, sera. We all go, yeah. But it was kind of funny, you know.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get a sense of when your family came here. They started the farm out on Clinton Road.
Right.
And then how did that family spread, and what did some of those folks do?
Well, many of them were involved a lot in the timber business. When Kennedy Mine went through one of its many bankruptcies, they owed your family, they listed the 10 largest creditors, and the Fuguria family was one of those. In fact, they were number 10 out of the list. But they had been supplying timber for the supports in the mine, and they couldn't pay for it. But a lot of them, I mean, they were in, Jim Fuguria was on the police department. We were related to the Dondero family. The Donderos were married into the Fuguria family. The Spinettas, Charlie Spinetta was the winery over here. He's a first cousin, or second cousin, I guess. Yeah, second cousin. But they've spread all over, the Fuguria family has. The farm up here, they prefer to call it a ranch, but it's prospering, it's doing well. Carolyn Fuguria and her husband are very actively involved in replanting a lot of the long lost old sites of apple trees that were only a special fruit that are just kind of died off. They're also raising, they're very much involved in the bee industry. They have beehives, they lease them out. They're doing a lot of things. They're very cognizant of the soil and the land and doing things that are eco, green, and so that part of the family is still there and still surviving.
That's a beautiful ranch. I've been on it several times.
Yeah.
And of course, Carolyn was very interested in Italian history and
oh, yeah.
has been researching for many years. When we first moved here, we bought, as I mentioned to you earlier, the Gatehouse Inn here on Jackson Gate Road. And
sure.
and she had a little shop over by in the back of Teresa's where she had her photo, color, one of the first color photo machines in Amador County, and she was doing a lot of Italian family research there, and she continues to do it to this day. And you've done a lot of research. Obviously, we're sitting here with a notebook in front.
Oh, she did this.
Oh, she did this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For me. And I've done, it's no excuse, but I've been so busy in my previous work that I have not had the time. And I retired. I absolutely said go. Once I hit 80, I retired. And I was only retired 3 months later. I got diagnosed with cancer of the tongue. And it became quite an involved thing because they had to remove a major portion of the tongue and part of the bottom of my mouth. And I wound up spending a lot of time in the hospital, almost 3 months in and out, 19 days one time, 10 days another. And so I was planning to travel. I have never been to, Uruguay. And I know that there are things I'd like to find in Montevideo. Because supposedly my great grandfather Ferrari, this man's father, had a warehouse there. And so I'm sure there's stuff I could uncover if I went down there to look. The population in Uruguay of Italians is quite large. It's like 30% or 40% of the population. And I had planned to go down there. I probably won't make it this year, but if health providing, if I can make it, I'm going to go next year for sure. And just dig around a little bit. It'd be kind of fun.
Should be fun, yeah.
Yeah.
You pointed to this, this man in this catalog you have of your family history.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this family and the eight children that they had. Do you know kind of where they all went?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, as I say, my grandfather, died when he was 37, and he had, seven children and a pregnant wife, and he was operated on, I will say, I'd always thought it was in Jackson. He was operated on in Stockton. I have a copy now of the newspaper article on that. So it was Stockton, not Jackson. And they gave him too much chloroform. They didn't even do the operation. So he died on an operating table. My grandmother died at 43 or 44. She was born in 1867 in Jackson.
And what was her name?
Clara.
And what was her maiden name?
Fergulia.
Fergulia, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she, as I said, was born in 1867. My grandfather, on my mother's side of the family, was born in 1863. And he used to always laugh. He said, I was born when Abraham Lincoln was president. Your grandmother was not born. She was born after Lincoln was assassinated. But if you look at Domenico, he was born in 1801. Who was president in 1801? I'm not sure. It was.
I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, there's not many. Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe. It's probably Monroe. Maybe not even that. Who knows? But, and he lived until he was 93. And as I say, he is buried here. The rest of the family, I had, the youngest one, the one that was born after his father had passed away, became at one time the second largest wholesale produce company in California. It was called California Produce, California. And it was next to A. Levy Zentner, which was the largest at that time. California Produce was the second largest.
And what was his name?
That was Angelo.
Angelo.
That was his name also, Angelo, but Angelo was the last child born in the family.
Was he a junior?
He would have been. Yeah, he would have been. And he had no sons, he had one daughter. I was very close to him. He wanted me to take over his business in the worst possible way. When I was living in Berkeley, his business was in Oakland. in the produce section, and I used to work there a lot. But they start at 2 a.m., and you load your trucks between 2 a.m. and 4 or 5 a.m., and then your trucks go out with the produce. When you're trying to go to school, it has to be at work at 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. And very honestly, I love my uncle dearly, but I didn't find the produce business something I was really excited about. Everybody worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. The only day you ever show off was Sunday, because the produce, you had to get it out and ship it. And he eventually sold his business, and then he passed away shortly after that.
Now, so his was a wholesale business.
Wholesale.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he was, if you had to look at success of those people in the family, of the boys, he was probably the most successful. Teresa, she and her husband, Steve Bignelli, started a restaurant here, but originally she worked as a waitress and washing dishes and everything at Teresa's restaurant down the street before she started her own. And she started her own shortly thereafter.
Go back there for a second. Teresa's restaurant down the street?
Right down here. Phil Giolani's.
Okay.
Yeah. That was Teresa Giolani.
Right.
And my aunt worked there as a young girl.
Oh, okay.
And then she started her own. She used to drive by with me in the car, and I said, well, there's another restaurant. She said, yeah, but the food's terrible. She said, oh, the food's terrible. Even when I moved back here, my wife said, how come we never go to Teresa? I said, the food's not any good. She said, how do you know? I said, my Aunt Teresa told me. She said, well, she has her own restaurant. That's what she would say. I always laugh about that. My aunt's food was really good.
Now, this is the old Wheel Inn. Is that the one you're talking about? Okay.
I mean, I used to go down there and pick all these blackberries and bring them back a bucket full. She'd make pies for the restaurant. I mean, raviolis, I was always there. I spent a lot of time. I think that's where my love of food really began. She spoiled the hell out of me. I had four aunts. Three of them, you know, direct and one by marriage. All loving Italian ladies. All of them were a little bit overweight, as most Italian older ladies are. And I was the only male child in my generation. And they would just grab me, and they would hug me, and they would squeeze my head between their breasts, and I was actually feeling like I was showing me choking to death. I had to scream and let them get loose. And one of them dropped me in the next one and grabbed me. Oh, God. I was always hiding from their hands because they wanted to hug me more. So I was a spoiled brat. And my father, in charge of the casino at the hotel downtown, on Saturdays, I'd walk in from the ranch, and I would just walk into the Rex or the Louvre or any one of his competition. They were all gambling, those kids. And they'd say, oh, here's Minnie's kid. And it was standard. They'd take a silver dollar and they'd flip it to me. I could always pick up $4 just by walking into those places. Well, $4 was a lot of money.
A lot of money, sure.
I would go to the theater, Jackman Theater, take three or four or five of my friends, and a ticket then, this is in 1941, 42, was 16 cents. I really wasn't good at even counting, but I knew a dime, a nickel, and a penny. It was 16 cents per person for a double feature. So I'd go in and slap down a silver dollar. All my friends would go in. Popcorn was 10 cents a bag, and that was a big bag. I was a big-time spender, you know. And it was all his money just for my dad's competitors flipping me a money.
Now, you said your dad was the manager of the casino. Tell our listeners where that casino was.
In the National Hotel.
In the National Hotel.
At the end of the street. And I met a lot of people there that, I mean, Earl Warren used to come, the governor of California. Pat Brown was the district attorney in San Francisco, and he used to come with Earl Warren. We'd have the district attorney in San Francisco, the governor of the state, and the other young men playing cards. They had a poker hall room too, slot machines, the whole thing. It was illegal. But they finally said, we gotta close it. And I know they called. I know my father was one of them that he called. John Fassini was his partner in that. And the thing I liked is they moved 100 slot machines from the hotel to our barn on Clinton Road. And I became very popular again because I had stacks of nickels and dimes, and all my friends would come over and play the slot machines out in my barn. And my dad finally sold them after a few months to somebody over in the arena. They bought our slot machines.
We know the configuration of the National Hotel now. It's obviously been modernized. But to some extent, the first floor is still what it was before. Where were these 100?
Well, the downstairs, there was a different entrance. The entrance now you have goes right down into the restaurant part. Just one door over was another door. It's still there, but it's been blocked off. Went into the bar. Okay? We went down, there was a long bar, and one whole wall on one side was slot machines, and then we went into a big back room. And in the back room, there were more slot machines and three blackjack tables. And
it was all in the basement.
It was all in the basement. And there was a restaurant down there also, but it was much smaller than the one now. The restaurant that was there was about the size of what the bar is now. Yeah. And it wasn't much. I mean, you know, it was a restaurant.
Right.
But it wasn't a fancy place like Mr. Lukowicz has. It was just a regular old place.
Yeah, so you had a lot of special experiences in that hotel. That
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a great place for a kid to grow up. It really was.
Did they actually pay any attention to the age of people in the casino? I mean, if you weren't 18, did you, or 21, or
there was no, they really didn't. Because we used to go to Reno, and my mother's relatives were all lived in Colorado, and we would visit them every summer. And my mother and I had one sister, but my sister and I and my mother and father, we would drive there. We always looked forward to it because it was a big outing, big trip for us. And we would go into one or two casinos in Reno, then Battle Mountain, then Elko, over to the Utah border. And we always went into casinos with our parents, and they would sit us right up at the blackjack table, and my daddy would say, well, I've got 17, you think I should ask for another card? You know, which he said, nobody paid much attention, as long as you were supervised by a parent, you know, some little kids not going to walk in there.
I have to ask this, I guess. I guess I've asked it to other interviewers.
Sure.
With respect to the ladies of the night.
That always comes up.
Yeah, it always comes up. And I'm always interested in the response, particularly from women, you know, in the community who lived here then. And, you know, like one lady said, I'm glad they were here, kept my husband away from me. That was her response.
Yeah.
But what did you think of all that when you were growing up? Was it even anything that was you were conscious of? Or?
Oh, yeah. We knew where they were.
Yeah.
And we knew what they were, sort of. As kids, with the old telephone system we had around here, which was the old-fashioned phone with a crank on the side.
Right.
We would call one of the houses, and they'd come and say, or some stupid thing, and we'd hang up. I mean, it was always just, oh my God, you know. But they closed those up too in the 50s, 55 or something like
something
that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. There were a lot of people that probably wouldn't want me to mention their names that had something to do with either ownership or Washington. I mean, it's all a matter of record. I mean, Jim Fugulia was getting paid off. There's no question. I mean, he was, you know, and other people were getting paid to make sure I mean, to give them police protection, I mean, to make sure if you got somebody, you got a fight going on or whatever, I mean, they get a lot of drugs that would go from the bars over there. So.
Yeah, it was pretty clear from the newspaper articles and the trials and so forth they had at that a lot of the local politicians or police department was involved in keeping that thing going for a long time.
We had one cousin, I can't think of the last name, her first name was Mamie, I think. And I think she was either a prostitute or she had somehow some connection because my aunt was never allowed to even mention her name. I never got the full story. Yeah.
Main Street, when you were growing up, was...
The Little Reno.
The Little Reno.
Oh, yeah. I can still feel those lights blazing all night long and cars and... Yeah. My uncle was chief of police. Earl Gabarini was chief of police. His father was the mayor before that. His father was a very skilled... mechanical engineer.
That was V.S. Garbarini.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Held a lot of patents and stuff for mining equipment and all that sort of stuff. In fact, I had some sort of this. Oh, that was just old Gavin. That was V.S. Gavin, supervisor. My uncle was also a supervisor.
Right. Yeah, there's a plaque to V.S. Yeah. Garbarini up on Vista Point that...
Right.
We put up there that there's copies the plaque that's on the rock by the National Hotel. So,
our family was like, I hate to say, most Italian families, very clannish, very, very protective of their own, but very jealous of their own too. I mean, I can remember my uncle, the one in the produce business, bought a new Cadillac. Well, nobody in the family ever had a Cadillac. He got such a ration of heat from his sisters and everybody that he came for Christmas, like the whole family always up here. He drove up in his new Cadillac. I mean, he couldn't get over it. 2 weeks later, he turned it in and bought a Ford. he did get a Thunderbird, which I thought was pretty nice. But I'm just saying, his sisters got him so bad. Who do you think you are? You, goddamn, what the hell are you doing? You embarrass us. Don't park that in front of my house.
The Wheel Inn is obviously boarded up now.
Yeah.
And has been for some time. But your Aunt Teresa's... Did they build that and start that as a restaurant?
Yeah.
And about what time?
Well, it was probably right after World War One. Right after World War One. So I don't know whether it was, 1920, 1921. It started like everything else, a boarding house.
Right.
And I can remember I spent a lot of time there. I mean, they had my uncle went in the bar. He had a bulldog named Jiggs, and the bulldog would get up and sit on a bar stool, and people would feed Jiggs chocolate bars.
Chocolate?
I understand it's not good for animals.
Right.
They loved to sit there. I had that big old bulldog eating that, and we had slot machines in there, of course. Now, when Bob Barfoot owned it, and you know Bob, I'm sure.
Correct, yeah.
Bob used to, I mean, he lived right down here. We would get together all the time, but... Bob said they had a crap table. I never saw a crap table. I never did. And I would have noticed. I mean, I would have known, but maybe they did before and took it out, or could be. I don't know.
Now, did you ever work in that restaurant?
Oh, yes. I did, but my Aunt Teresa was of my aunts, Teresa Bignosi was the one that was the most affectionate to me. I mean, they were all affectionate. They were all nice, but Aunt Teresa was the one that, she always wanted a son, and she just had the one daughter, so I was really like her son, and she, I was going there helping make raviolis. I was going there and do all kinds of cooking things. You know, I mean, go out and do this. I was at this, go in and get this for me and go get that. Or that, you know, just general stuff, just to keep me busy.
Did Bob Barfoot buy that restaurant from your family?
No. My family sold it to a lady by the name of Sullivan, Mrs. Sullivan. She owned a place up in 88. And then she's the one that built the motel. That was just open land. So, and I mean, I met her, I saw her, but I didn't know much about. And then my aunt moved to Stockton because she became quite ill as she got older. And her daughter was the head of the welfare department up here, Marguerite Pignotti. And she was my first cousin. And so they moved to Stockton for the last 10 years of their life. And I had, Kate, the one that really ran the family here, moved to Stockton. She married a man in Stockton, and they had three children, and successful life. My cousin was chief of police in Stockton for a while, the last few years of his life. And the other one was the president of Richmond Chase Cameron. So they were reasonably successful. Within their own peer group, they were just fine.
To change the subject just a bit, you obviously have an interest in food, and you didn't mention in your little personal history earlier about your involvement in the restaurant business.
Yeah, it's well, I own three restaurants, and one of them was called the Kaiser Fall, and it was in Los Angeles. And the theme behind it was based on the movie The Kaiser Fall, about the female impersonators. We had a very good restaurant, but it also had a floor show on the weekends, and this was female impersonators. They were all men dressed as women, and it wasn't my idea to do this, but this was proposed to me, and I looked at it, and we liked the idea, because it really, really put us over in bringing in the right kind of people for the restaurant. We had an excellent chef, and I spent a good time overseeing what was going on in the kitchen from my perspective. Not cooking specifically, because I was already doing a lot of other things. But this was at a time when we were getting lots of Japanese visitors because of the wealth in Japan coming to Southern California particularly. And so on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday nights, our people in that restaurant were almost 80 to 90% Japanese tourists. And they loved it, and they spent money like you could not believe. It came in busloads. It caught on in Japan and everything. You've got to go to the Kaiser Fall when you go to Los Angeles. And then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, but particularly Friday and Saturday, it was a hit with the Hollywood crowd. And that's when we used to, Johnny Carson used to come at least once a month with several of his friends. Liberace used to come all the time. And then so many other celebrity types would show up. And of course, once the word got out, just so people were making a thing, everybody wanted to go there. And at the time, I mean, I put up $500,000, which was a lot of money. I thought it was a lot of money. It was a lot of money for me. But that's when I found out that one of my partners wasn't stealing, but he knew the other partner was stealing. And once I found out, and could be very specific as what it was, I said, hey, this is it. Here's your option. Buy me out now, 2 weeks time, or I'm going to prosecute you.
Trust in the restaurant business is of a necessity.
And I had a restaurant in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called Pollo Fiesta, which was very similar to Pollo Loco. It was a large, all chicken. It was, it looked, I mean, we did I went to Mexico. I used to have my own airplane, and I flew a lot. And I used to fly down Hermosillo all over in Mexico. I wouldn't dare do it today. I mean, the only reason they steal the plane so fast down there. But
when did you start? When did you become a pilot?
1974, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I started with a Piper, a twin engine Piper, but it was not pressurized, and it wasn't a turboprop.
Don't people usually start with a single engine plane?
Yeah, but I started with a twin. I mean, you could really uncomfortably have four people, but you had counter-rotating props. So it was a stable, twin, but it was not fast, and it wasn't pressurized. And so after about 9 months, I bought an Aerostar, 601P, pressurized. I could go up to 30,000 feet, turbocharged. It had a cruising speed in miles per hour of about 310 miles an hour. It was the fastest twin-engine business. It was originally designed as a jet, but to test it, they put piston engines in to test the airplane, and it performed so well, they said, we don't need a jet, we just need a piston engine. And eventually it was bought out by Piper, but it was A.E. Smith, who was an aircraft designer, that designed Aerostar, and then he sold out to Piper. But I had that for 5 years, and put over 12,000 hours, lots and lots of time.
So you were using that in your business?
Absolutely. The reason I finally had to sell it was that my accountant and my wife and my other business partners said, hey, for you to go from Albuquerque to San Francisco costs us $2,000, and we can go in Southwest for $99 each way. I said, yeah, but get there. They said, no, you don't even get there faster. Don't give us that shit. And so my father said, okay.
So that was one of your poorer business decisions then?
No, it was great. I loved every minute of it.
I'll bet.
But it wasn't.
And your partners took out a lot of insurance on you.
Yeah.
I had a partner in business, and as soon as he started flying, my other partner and I took out a lot of insurance on him. Fortunately, he lived.
Yeah. Well, I was young and foolish. I was in my 40s, late 40s, early 50s. I did enjoy it, and I used to fly it myself a lot, but I had a pilot. In Albuquerque, I had a pilot, because when I was really working hard, I couldn't. You kill yourself if you try to work hard, get in planes and fly at night. I would take off from Albuquerque and fly to Oklahoma City, and that was only like an hour and 20 minutes. I'd have a meeting there, and then I'd have lunch in Dallas, and I'd wind up having dinner in Atlanta. And then I'd climb on the plane, and he might fly me to Miami, and I'd sleep all the way down. I really got around, and at certain times, because the nature of my business was heavily oriented towards tax, because a lot of our investors wanted to make sure that everything was done and recorded by the end of a calendar year. So they put off closing a lot of times until October, November, December, just balancing their own books in the way things were.
Right.
And so I used to run around a lot right at the very end, getting things done at the last moment.
So to kind of finish up today's talk, is there anyone in your family or anybody in the neighborhood, any character that you would like to make a comment about? Or?
Well, there's lots of characters. Everyone here is sort of a character. Well, I love all the people who went to Teresa's restaurant there. It's a great place. I go in there and see Teresa herself and Phil and Joe and, all the help. And they bring up a lot of things that they remember from the past. certainly Jimmy Vinciguerra, Mr. Ravioli over there. I've known his family forever.
He's a character.
Oh, total. And my cousin, Charlie Spinetta. I mean, Charlie's a real success story, you know, from the little Milligan school. And he was younger. His older brother and I used to pick on him all the time, and he'd bring us lunchbox to lunch, and we knew his mother was a really good cook. So we just go over and take his lunchbox, and we go through his sandwiches. We take out a peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and take his salami and cheese and stuff. He said, that's yours now. And he's been more successful than any of us. I mean, he,
Charlie moved, I don't know his story, but he kind of moved away from here and then came back too, didn't he?
Well, he really didn't move away much. What he did was he went to UC Berkeley. He was 3 years behind me. I was graduating when he was coming in as a freshman. He got a degree in forestry. Went to work for Georgia Pacific. I'm sure it was Georgia Pacific. And did real well by finding some out-of-the-way places where timber land was there that was hard to go in to take the trees out. And he found ways to get it done and started his own company by going back and buying those properties and trading them with other people. And that led him to buying his land over in Shenandoah Valley and establishing his winery. And he's done really well. And he has 3 boys are all involved in the business.
Right. That's a nice family.
Nice family. And he's basically built from nothing to a very substantial 8-figure net worth.
Yeah. He's very generous with his money too, and as part of the Historical Society, he's made several contributions that are of significance. And certainly we appreciate that.
Yeah.
I lost my train of thought.
That's all right.
I know what it was. You've mentioned UC Berkeley several times, and the thought occurs to me, here out at the gate, I know that Marion Cuneo, who's passed away, she went to UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
Phil Giuliani went to UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
I think his sister went.
Babe Gabrini.
Pardon?
Babe Gabrini. He was there. This guy's in the hospital. I just went to him. Hey, Steve.
Okay, I think we're recording.
I was just commenting about when I was in high school, at Stockton High School, I was student body president, and the principal belonged to Rotary, and the boys, dean of boys, belonged to Lions Club. And the big deal was supposed to be that the student body president went to lunch with both of them. So I got the choice of Lions Club and Rotary. Rotary was very proper. Always, they usually had nice speakers like the governor,
right.
things like that. Whereas Lions Club, they were throwing food and yelling, and you talk about 180 degree difference. Not that one was bad and one was good.
Right.
Both totally different. But here I was, this 18-year-old kid looking at all this stuff. Oh my God.
Yeah, when I was vice principal in Pleasanton, and the principal was a Rotarian, and on occasion he would take there were 4 vice principals, he would take one of us with him, and that's kind of how I got involved with it. That was 30 years ago, so it's been a while. But back to what we were talking about, which was UC Berkeley.
I mean,
was there... it just seems like there's so many people in this particular area. Was it something that came up when you were in high school, or when in family gatherings? You're going to go to Berkeley as opposed to someplace else.
No, it really wasn't. In my case, I mean, my parents were happy to hear that I wanted to go to college. I mean, they didn't make a big thing about it, but they expected me to go to college. And I only applied to 2 schools. I applied to Stanford, and I played the cow. I mean, I knew about him because the books I did, right? I didn't get any scholarships or anything like that. It was, you know, I had decent grades, but a lot of people had decent grades. Anyway, I got the application. I was accepted at both. I remember sitting down with my parents. I said, well, is this Stanford? Oh, yeah, no, that's nice. Here's Cal. Stanford, I think it was $12,500 or whatever then. And Berkeley was for a full semester, and you could get, you had to take 12 or more units, which $42 and $3 for a parking permit if you had a car. It was $45. And my dad just said, he just, well, you're going to really love it, Cal. Yeah, that was it.
That was it.
I didn't have any, you know. And, well, and to me, at that point in time, it didn't really matter at all. It really didn't.
Well, it was obviously a little easier to get into Stanford and Cal back then than it is today.
Much, much, much. Yeah. Yeah, it was, I couldn't get in now. I mean, I had my grandson who's a 4.4 average. He's a senior at the University of Wisconsin. But they wouldn't accept him at Cal. He applied to like 9 schools and was accepted in all but, Stanford was on some kind of a wait list, and Cal was just a no.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to get into college and very expensive, obviously, today.
Both of my daughters went to UC Santa Barbara, but that was after 2 years of JC Junior College, and they did the last 2 years at UC Santa Barbara.
Well, it always amazes me in conversation with people, as I said kind of earlier, that so many people in this particular area, I call the gate, ended up at UC.
I'm Berkeley. Surprised too. I mean, I don't know what's it. Maybe because it's close. I don't know.
Well, it also surprised me with that some of the people that I'm talking about, you know, who have passed away, some of them, you know, and now would be close to 100, you know, 100 years ago, a woman from the small county of Amador going down to Berkeley. It just seems as that there's a history of adventurism, you know, a willingness to do something and that's kind of out of the ordinary in my mind for the general populace.
I loved being there. I thought it was fantastic. Cool. It was not easy, but I loved it. I loved the proximity of San Francisco. It was so much difference in those. I mean, San Francisco was a lot easier to get around.
Right.
Much less expensive. Oh, God.
I never got to interview Gloria Tam.
The
Tam family. But as a young girl, she picked up and went on her own to New York City. I mean, it's like, you know, she did share that with me one day in a conversation, but wasn't willing to sit down and talk like you are. And I certainly appreciate your willingness to chat.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do this again.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of history. I mean, we could go to see this and I could show you the Garavantes and the Arditos and the Grotellis. The Grotellis are in Tracy now. They're very big in the cattle feeding business. They have a huge feedlot down there. But there is a lot of funny history around here. I mean, I'm sure a lot of it's bullshit, but
a lot of it took place. I mean, such as you've shared with us today. So we'll wrap this one up and we look forward to talking to you.
Well, you've gone way, way over your time. Let me show you my backyard as you walk out.
Very good. Let me shut this off.
Oh, yeah. These pictures.